Hey, everybody, this is Matt. I just wanted to preface this episode with a little bit of a disclaimer and a little bit of a welcome to any new listeners we may have. First of all, just for new listeners, these episodes, we wish they could come out like sort of every week on a consistent day, but they just don't do that. Our schedules don't really permit that to happen. And also, I'm a lazy person. Like, Hillary has a real job and I'm a lazy person. So that's like a combination for bad scheduling. So with that said, don't be afraid to read ahead. I mean, we kind of envision that people have read the whole novel first before they listen to this. And we certainly are coming at these novels from a position of like having finished them all. So, you know, we may allude to things that happen later in the novel than the sections that we're explicitly discussing for that day. So, you know, go ahead and read the whole novel and then reread with us if you are so inclined. On this episode in particular, it's coming out a little bit later, and it's also a lot longer than our normal episodes typically are. We usually like record for an hour or so. The reason for that is we started recording on Sunday and we had huge technical difficulties. I record in Maine, Hillary records in Chicago. So we had to stop on Sunday and pick back up on Monday. So if there's a bit of repetition here, that's why. Also, if there's a bit of audio inconsistency, that's also why. You'll notice around half an hour into the episode, there's a little bit of a musical break. That's us taking a necessary break from recording and picking back up. So in any event, just wanted to alert you guys to that. And thank you for listening very much. And welcome if you're a new listener. We really appreciate it, and we really appreciate hearing from you. You can email us or tweet at us at the links provided in the show notes. Hope you enjoy these discussions, these very freewheeling, non-formed, random discussions, which is typical of what we do. So, on with the show. Hello.
Oh, hello.
It's Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary. I'm Matt.
And I'm Hillary.
This is our Kim Stanley Robinson read-along podcast where right now we are reading his brand new novel, The Ministry for the Future.
We certainly are. And I don't remember what we talked about last time. I remember, of course, that it was great. It was a great conversation.
Always is. Never not.
I remember it was extraordinary, actually. Our idea for today is that we're going to be talking about, this is just, you know, alert to everybody. We're talking about approximately chapters 17 to 38. That's kind of our plan. Yeah. I do remember from our last convo that we totally failed at our plan. I remember that from our last conversation and also most of the events of our lives that we...
Yeah.
That's kind of the plan for today. And I think we were going to start off talking a little bit about Frank, who's one of the main characters. It does seem worth saying just quickly, because I now have gotten to finish the book. So the last time we talked, I was only like 200 pages into it. And I think it's really it's magnificent. I don't have a reading about it yet. And I think that's something I think is going to develop in the conversations that we have, maybe not even a full-fledged reading. But I do feel like it's important to think about how this is a book that's quite... it's quite interested not only in sort of like capturing different voices, but in not necessarily specifying those voices for you.
Yes.
And actually in having you hear from some things like the sun or carbon or a mm-hmm. photon that we don't think of as having voices at all. So, I mean, and this actually, I think this actually like leads us into thinking a bit about Frank pretty well. But I think that one of the things that the novel is interested in is not only creating or, you know, like producing this kind of like array of voices, but not letting you sort of like feel like you know the whole story, so or even know whose voices these are, so not letting you always personalize who you're hearing from.
Yeah, that's really important.
And as I think like a lot of people remember in New York 2140, Robinson has these kind of like sections that are kind of choral, the citizen or citizen's voice. And here there's some of that technique, but we also have sections that are like notes from a meeting, and we have sections that are basically like lists. And as I think Matt said last time, like some of the sections feel like op-eds, although mostly like op-eds from like, you know, no fucking newspaper that actually exists, obviously.
Unfortunately.
And some of them are dialogues, right? But I think it would be worth thinking that this is not because this book is like failing at doing character for us or something like that.
Right.
I think it's actually because it's not only interested in this, like, you know, kind of capturing a wide array of possible kinds of positions and bringing them together, but it's also pretty interested in like getting you to think about things that can't be located within or maybe even comprehended by a sort of an individual person's brain, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that, anyway, yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah. I mean, I think that's, I thought we would come around to that exact point, is that like this, you know, all of his books are multi-perspectival books, but usually the perspectives are the perspectives of like human beings. And here we have the perspectives of like the sun being or carbon being or capital being, you know? And also within those other human beings that we do experience the world of this novel through, which is sort of closest to the world of our world than he's come, you know, maybe in quite a long time at least. That, you know, it is a kind of, I don't know how to say it. Like, it's definitely third person, but it's like almost sort of just like this free floating third person, getting all of these different, getting this problem from all of these different perspectives, in a way that, you know, gives a more three-dimensional picture of the interlocking set of problems that we face, from the political to the cultural to the climatological to the economic. And so in that way, like, I think I've seen a lot of criticism that it's kind of weak on character, that there's no one to identify with. I think I disagree with that on like pretty much every level. I think like Frank and Mary are both pretty interesting characters once you finish the book. In the case of Frank, like from the very beginning, it's hard to dissociate yourself from him because you're so inside of his, not just his mind, but his body from the very beginning of the of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But I think the other thing is these chapters that are like from the perspective of a refugee, one which is in this chunk that we'll read today, that we'll discuss today. Despite the fact that this is a refugee from Tunisia, they have a very like sympathetic or like identifiable set of problems that they face. Like, it's not like, I don't need to know like what this person's favorite flavor of ice cream is or something like that to understand like what this person is going through in a refugee camp in Switzerland. You know what I mean? In part, I don't need to know that because I've been seeing the riots in like Portland and Minneapolis on the news for the last 6 months, you know? These things are just very like real and vital and kind of present they should be to all of our experiences, whether mediated or immediate, right now. So
Yeah. I mean, I think that the actually a good, like a that is just like making me think like a really good way to think about what kind of the sort of narrative, the multiple kinds of narrative modes, I'm just going to call it, that's like maybe not technically the right thing to say, but like something like that, the multiple different kinds of narrative modes that we see here. One really good way to think about them is through the figures of the refugees, some of whom we do end up seeing as full-fledged characters in that, in minor characters, but still full-fledged characters, and others of whom we don't meet in that mode at all. But like, you know, at some point later on in the novel, this doesn't give anything away to say this, like we get all of these questions raised about like what's going to happen with refugees, right? And there's a moment where Mary is talking to somebody, maybe even to Frank, and it's like, well, you know, like, but are they like real refugees or are they climate refugees, you know? Or are they, you know, I mean, sorry, are they real refugees or are they economic refugees? Sorry, that's the distinction I wanted to make. And you know, part of the point of the way that we receive those stories here and how we see them enfolded into all of these other larger logics, like you were just saying, like thinking about like our own moment, like even within the borders of the United States, like part of the point of it is like there's no fucking difference, right? Like to be a climate refugee, to be a refugee from war, to be a quote unquote economic refugee, these are actually like the same. These are the same thing, right? These are about people who are at the mercy of large impersonal or maybe not totally impersonal forces. And by not sort of like answering a set of questions about them, we also aren't put in the position of being like, you know, the like benevolent Euro-American savior who's going to like judge whether this person is like a worthy refugee or not, right? Instead, we just know like, oh, so we're reading a world that is exactly like our world and that people are being displaced for all kinds of reasons at, you know, extraordinary personal risk. And to demand from those people that they like unfold stories for us that can make us feel satisfied or say like, oh yeah, you know, like you're a real refugee. Like that demand is like absolutely one that we should be setting aside, right? And yet, you know, like that impulse to like demand the story that lets us make convenient sense of another person. I think that that's one of the things that's actually kind of being, we could think that this novel is sort of like taking that on quite critically.
So yeah, I think that this point about the novel, like the challenge that the novel poses to us is a really, really interesting challenge because this is like not a normal kind of novel, clearly. Mm-hmm. And I think last week even we were I think actually after we recorded, we were chatting via text and I brought up like Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. In part because when I spoke with Stan a couple months ago, he told me that he's like always rereading Moby Dick. So that kind of like stood out for me in a certain way. But the interesting thing about the kind of about that comparison is that Moby Dick is just the weirdest, one of the weirdest novels ever because like its narrative, the actual like narrative of Moby Dick could fit into like less than half of the actual length of Moby Dick. Like most of Moby Dick is just like weird shit about whales and like the history of whaling and like all kinds of stuff that doesn't have anything to do with Captain Ahab, like fighting the white whale. And here we have like all these different types of chapters and types of information that goes beyond narrative, but that weaves us together into like a coherent world and a real picture of the world that we live in and that we're going to be living in, like whether we want to or not, over the next, you know, the rest of our lives for the rest of human civilization, if we choose to, and if we can get our shit together. And so in that regard, like narrative is kind of out the window. Like we have the narrative, the main narrative is the one that of Mary and her relationship within the Ministry of the Future and the things that she has to do with that. And then her relationship with Frank, which, you know, we'll obviously talk about in a minute. And then these other like sort of offshoots. But so like with Mary being the main character, again, like she occupies far less than half the novel, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so for people looking for like a traditional novel, you're not going to find it here. And what you're going to find, though, is something that's, you know, I think really vital and really challenging in a way, in exactly the way that the future of humankind on Earth is going to challenge us. Because we're going to be challenged to know and think about things and have empathy for people who we don't know and we'll never meet. And not only like people that we cohabit the Earth with now, but people who might live 100 years from now, mm-hmm. like the seven generations thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that this novel itself is a kind of like window into that mode of being.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and also people who are not people, right? I mean, that's, I think, you know, I was thinking the like refugees work quite well for making you think about one aspect of this kind of problem or why you might be interested in sort of putting some pressure on our tendency to feel like what we need is like the resonant story of an individual or a family or something in order to understand like the bigger picture.
Charismatic megafauna.
Yeah.
Yeah, like human being as charismatic megafauna. That is is kind of like the thing that this novel will not be giving you.
Yeah. And I think that the along with that, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that like the, you know, I mean, the Mars books do that too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a lot of stuff about character. Mm-hmm. But as we talked about a lot when we were talking about those books, like however much you may feel that you have like, you know, an intense relationship to Maya, and how could you not? Mm-hmm. Like at the same time, there are just like huge chunks of her ultra long life that you know nothing about.
Right.
You know, and they can get told in a totally different way in The Martians. And that might, you know, like sort of push back on the idea that that she or Nadia or, you know, John Boone or here Frank or Mary are like representative, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, I think that if one of the cognitive, quote unquote, cognitive errors that we learn about in this book, which people may also remember learning about in Aurora, is ease of representation, in which you feel like from your very small, like possible sample size of the people that you actually know, you feel certain that you know vastly more people and more about the world than you do. I mean, that's to put it like pretty roughly.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a kind of pushback here on that version of representation, as well as the version in which like one particularly charismatic or interesting or event-laden life can stand in for lives at large, mm-hmm. Which I think we could also think about in like a, you know, a kind of subtle way, and we probably won't get to this in detail until later in the novel. But I mean, I think you could also think that about that as pushing back on ideas about like political representation, mm-hmm. too, right? Speaking for, you know, that seems really important to me. And then, of course, the other reason to like think about that sort of like why we might be interested in stuff that is impersonal, mm-hmm. Is because like this is one of the often kind of articulated sort of ideas or like worries about climate change is like the problem that like these problems are so fundamentally impersonal, you know, the melting of the Arctic sea ice, that we, you know, we humans can't like grapple with them. Is it that we can't, you know, like, so we can, you know, like the charismatic megafauna work for us. Like we can cry watching like the polar bear like float away on the ice floe or whatever is happening, mm-hmm. but not when we think about like a glacier melting.
Right.
Right. And like, what's the counter to that? And I think it's like very easy within, I think it's like a classic, you know, a classic mode, a thing that the realist novel does, mm-hmm. and a thing that like liberalism, at least since the, you know, in its Victorian form, but I also think now does, is to say like, oh, well, we'll get around this problem of how like the issue that we're grappling with is actually really enormous. We'll get around that by telling you a story of an individual.
Right.
Right. And I actually think that, like you were saying, like I actually find both Frank and Mary quite satisfying as characters,
right.
in a lot of ways. And I find Badim also, yes. a very satisfying character who, mm-hmm. I love and, you know, would be quite into like reading his book too.
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like in a big way, like his story is almost, you know, more interesting than Mary's, like,
yeah.
in terms of like what he hints at, like the things that he's done. But yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Oh yeah. I mean, obviously we'll get to that on, yeah. another day, but you know, like, but despite all that, I think that the sort of, I think it's worth thinking about, this novel as being like really seriously interested in giving you stuff that you can't enfold into a story about a character.
Right.
And that doesn't work to say like this refugee stands in for all refugees, even as at the same time, like hearing these pieces of story or, you know, the enslaved workers on the fishing vessel that we talked about last time, like hearing the pieces of this story may tell you something about something bigger, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is the same as saying that like this novel is like cold or doesn't call on,
right.
like compassion. I mean, I honestly, like, I at some point I marked the chapter, it's a bunch away from where we are now, I started crying and didn't stop crying until the end of the book.
I mean,
I think, like, you know, that's really not what the issue is. I think,
yeah.
the issue is like pushing on the way that we think and what we think that, like, you know, and pushing back a little on the ways in which like a novel can either be dystopian, tell you everything is shit,
yeah.
or give you comfort and tell you everything is just like going to be fine. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it really, you know, we should wrap this up and start actually talking about some like specific things that happen in a novel. But as we're saying, it pushes against the very notion of what a novel is and the genre of a novel in the realist tradition in that way. So that, yeah, an individual character is a way in, but this novel is sort of saying like that is far too limiting a method, a technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
For addressing the science fiction that is our reality, right? That Robinson is always talking about. The science fiction is the realism of our time. We live in science fictional times. And, you know, what better genre than science fiction to push against the notion of a self-contained individual, mm. of what we're given to be, of what subjectivity is, mm-hmm. how it's thrust, mm-hmm. upon us, and what ideology is, and all of those things, and to kind of be given an opportunity through a novel, through a play form of technology, as Walter Benjamin would say about the film, about cinema, to test out how we can transcend or overcome or, you know, supersede that mode of being that traps us in our individual subjectivities, and makes us only worry about, you know, the handful of people that we know or that we think we know, or that because we think we know them, give us a sense of like what everybody, quote unquote, feels like,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like saying, how do you like stay with the trouble, to like use,
yes.
like Donna Haraway's phrase? It's like hard to stay with it.
Yeah.
But maybe like necessary.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, to talk about the book, like what was your sort of, if we're going up to section, 38, we've actually gotten like quite a ways with Frank. Mm-hmm. And like, what was your sort of like take on him or your experience of reading him in this first kind of like piece of his story?
Frank is, you know, and I think that this goes back to something that I was bringing up last time, which is like, who is the reader? And especially in regards to like, who are these characters in relation to the reader? And I think with Frank and Mary, in my view, being the two main characters, I think that's pretty safe to say. We have on the one hand, the experience of a person who has been, who by his own account has died. Like he's a dead, yeah. He's a walking dead man.
Right. He says that to Mary.
Yeah. And that he, you know, has directly experienced the worst thing that could happen to you as a human being, which is being parboiled by the sun, having nowhere to escape, you know, being on the phone with your headquarters and being like, we need help. You need to send us help. And them saying everywhere needs help. There's nowhere from which we could send help to you. And if there was, we would need to be sending that help everywhere. So like, there is literally no escape. You are being boiled alive inside your own skin. And he loses his mind. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we can accept the fact that he died. He was among at least the land of the dead. Like, there's a kind of mythological quality to this where everyone around him was dead. And suddenly, somehow, for some reason, he survived. They tell him maybe it was because you had extra body mass, maybe because X, Y, and Z. And they have this discussion. I think it's at the end of 18, maybe, or somewhere, where it's like that. It was fate. It wasn't 18. It was somewhere else. It was fate. You know, why ever it was, that's what happened. And so he's a character that I feel like, you know, is extremely uncomfortable to identify with, but is a character with whom we must push ourselves to kind of understand and identify. And the book goes a long way in doing that. What do you think about Frank? There's a cat in front of your... We're entering the cat portion of the recording.
The hilarious cat portion. I think he may sit down. So I think that Frank is actually quite an interesting character in a lot of ways. I think he's both an interesting character because of the kind of both central and in some ways like... kind of sidelined role that he plays in the plot of the novel. And then I also think he's really central because he, I think you said before that when he is talking to Mary after he's like taken her hostage or however we want to describe what he's doing there, that he talks about himself as dead, as having died. And I think I think it's worth taking really seriously the idea of him as a sort of figure who has come back from the dead. I think that you suggested like even from the world of the dead, you know, if we think about what that first chapter like looks like, you know. And he's also, so I think that, I think that something that interests me about him is that in some ways he's kind of to one side of the narrative. So his relationship with Mary matters a lot. It feels like he matters a lot, but he's not a figure who like, makes the world of the novel go, right? And some of that is maybe because he's in this kind of strange position of being the living dead, some of it is because he is a survivor. He's a survivor with PTSD, which in chapter 18, but also in other parts of the novel, we learn a lot about, like, really specifically about PTSD and about the ways in which cognitive behavioral therapy and some other therapeutic modalities try to deal with PTSD, try to deal with, like, how do you manage to live in the world if you and also your brain and, like, your pathways in your brain are just constantly recurring to this one traumatic scene that you were in, turning back to it again and again, right? And we get some sense that there is something in the narrative that is maybe also interested in the idea of PTSD as a kind of widespread condition of living, probably not just in the moment of this world, the world of the novel, so that the 20s and 30s, but also our world, so the 20s, and the kind of combination of being sort of overly immersed in a moment, and also cut off from the ability to manage it or do something about it or move on from it, which I think is, like, that those are, like, resonant ways to think about what PTSD is or does. And they're also pretty resonant ways to think about, like, what it's like to be living in a crisis that both feels like crisis and like a kind of imperceptible motion, something all around you, something that's just the way the world is, something that you can't do anything about.
It makes me think about, like, the phrase, or I don't know if it's a real phrase or if it's just a new phrase that has become real, but it's very clear, a clarifying one, like, capitalism is the crisis. The PTSD that he's suffering is a kind of, because for him, the way that he's suffering this PTSD is like, why isn't everybody feeling the way that I'm feeling now?
Right.
And that can kind of really map on to us as, like, subjects of capital when we first encounter, like, radical theory or politics, and it clicks for us. And you start, I remember, like, I mean, this is still kind of my experience, but I'm just becoming inured to it. Like, walking into a shopping mall after, like, really starting to absorb Marx and that kind of thing, and being like, this is a nightmare. This is the worst. What did we do? Like, this is terrible. And so, I mean, it's kind of, and you do sound like a crazy person to someone who is either, like, already woken, quote unquote, already woke for, like, many decades, or someone who is still, quote unquote, asleep, to try to explain, like, why, walking through an airport and having, like, so many ads for, like, luxury watches luxury luggage, like, thrust in your face, why that's a nightmare, why it's, like, so off-putting and terrible, to explain that to somebody who doesn't get it, who isn't on your same wavelength and vibing with you. You sound like a crazy person.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's kind of like the experience that Frank has in Mary's kitchen, where Mary is, like, just calmly sipping tea, and he's like, you need to do something more about this crisis that we are in, right?
Yeah, I think that that, I think that that comment, the comment that you're making is really interesting, partly because, one, it might make us think about, why, for example, people turn to, like, conspiracy theories. And while I don't think that this is not a conspiratorial novel, like, this, gives you the kind of, like, I think there's something that's just, like, quite, like, I don't know. It's, like, just, like, the plain old truth to talk about, like, how few people there are who have, the most blame to bear, and do the most direct damage, and are doing the most direct damage to the world that we're in. But the desire to make sense of things, to have something that pulls it all together and makes it make sense. And, often when people start on the process of, like,
you know, thinking about like what our relationship is to capital, like the first thing that people reach for is like something like conspiracy theory as a way to explain it, because it feels like if you can say there are like these bad people who are doing this thing to us, right? Then you know what to do about it. And like a more sophisticated version of that is like when you're like, oh, capital reaches these like periodic points of crisis, as we might well think that we're in now, right? And like in a kind of unsophisticated understanding of that crisis, like that's a moment in which certain contradictions come to the fore, and you know the impulse is to think like, well, like if we're like living in and experiencing the contradictions, like then you know like we're seeing through it or whatever, but like seeing through it isn't enough, right? Because mm-hmm. like we also reproduce it, you know, by our very like processes of going about filling our needs, right?
unintentionally, which is the crisis that Frank comes to is that, okay, now I know this, now I have this knowledge, what am I going to do about it? Yeah. I have to act.
Yeah.
And what action can I do? And at one point he, you know, he accidentally kills somebody, and then he tries to intentionally kill somebody and he can't bring himself to do it. And then he intentionally kidnaps Mary to her own apartment and is a, as she puts it, a polite kidnapper.
Right.
Like allows him to like make boiling hot tea, he allows her to make boiling hot tea. He allows her to go to the bathroom. He doesn't do her any physical violence. And he's just kind of in, you know, having a manic episode that he needs somebody to like listen to, that who he believes, you know, who he believes in a certain metaphorical sense and a certain literal sense knows the future. Like,
knows the future.
You're the ministry of the future. You know the future. You know these things are going to happen. And she's like, actually, I don't know that these things are going to happen. Probably they're going to happen, but that's as close as science can get to us, get us to that, right? Like science can get us to like, yes, probably these things are going to happen. But it's not, because it's not a conspiracy theory, because it's beyond intention. The best we can do is say, yes, in all likelihood, these things will happen.
I think that I think a lot of the book is about thinking about the kind of just how complicated the relations are between intention and action, like what you intend or what you want to make happen, what you do or what you just do or what you can make happen, right? As well as between like the location of power, let's just like generally say power, like within individuals or like, you know, groups of individuals, or whether it is in some ways like systemic or structural or more more dispersed. I think it's really interesting to look at the sort of sequence of chapters from the one where Frank actually does kill someone, which is chapter 21, mm-hmm. Which is at this like, like fucking rich people's party on the Swiss side of Lake Maggiore.
Party for assholes.
Yeah. It's a party for assholes, where they're like dicks to him, basically. And then he seems to have at there, like not intended actually to kill the person, but just to hit him. But he kills him. And then the next chapter we have is one of the ones in the sequence of thinking about geoengineering and drilling into the glaciers, right? And so that is already an interesting kind of juxtaposition between the position of the scientist who in some ways, like, you know, they are actually like thinking and planning and ultimately are going to like do something that has an effectivity to it, right? But also like, you know, it's like an interesting problem in their heads for them, as opposed to the position that Frank is in, which is not at all like that.
This is really interesting thinking about it in the context of the conversation that we're having, because it's not something I thought of previously, but like in that chapter, it's Adele and Bob who are part of the Ministry for the Future. And then they meet some, you know, glaciologists who one of them has an idea, Slawek has an idea that, you know, Pete makes him share or whatever. And I guess Pete, we pick up later, he becomes a kind of a minor character.
Yeah.
But Slavik has this idea, which Stan has said in interviews that this is like the one kind of science fictional idea that he is popularizing right now for this. Like, it's one guy's idea, one glaciologist's idea. It might work. Stan is kind of picking it up and running with it. But what's interesting about this chapter and the way that it's laid out is you have some glaciologists talking to some politicians. And the glaciologists are like, well, we're just scientists. This is an idea here. And the politicians are like, well, cool. Could you like help us with this? And they're like, no, not really. We're scientists. We don't do this kind of thing. That's your job. And this is really interesting to me because it is a depiction of the division of labor working in a way that that it works and that it could be put to use to work, right? Like, there is a division of labor in terms of like what scientists do and what politicians do and how we might like bring those two together in a way that would like transcend. It's not about undoing the division of labor in some kind of like antediluvian, like we're going to go back to this antediluvian Marx idea, like where we're all going to like hunt and fish and do our gardening and do our, you know, the division of labor is.
Why not?
Well, because we need somebody to do the science, and like that takes a lot of time and effort, and you can't do all that science down in like Antarctica and like be in two places at once, also in like Zurich, making an argument for the continued funding of the science that you're doing down in the Antarctica, right? You can't be the guy who is a specialist at drilling the holes in Antarctica and be the guy who is like proofreading the scientific papers that go in the journals that then spread all around the world and then like generate new ideas that then wind their way back down to not only to Antarctica, but to Washington, D.C. and all that stuff. Like, you can't be the person who does literally all of those things. It takes a collective effort, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the idea of getting rid, I mean, whatever, this is another conversation. Like, I mean, but the idea that like under communism, we would not have to specialize, like, doesn't suggest that like there would be no like difference between what people did or everybody would have to do everything all the time, right? And rather, like, it's an idea about what it looks like when you don't have the world divided up as though, you know, different knowledge projects were inherently exclusive of one another, right?
Yeah, I hope I wasn't saying that. I think I was trying to, as I normally do, it's a natural role that I take. I was giving a dumb guy's version of the elimination of the division of labor under communism.
But I do, I mean, I think the point is good, right? Because like, you know, none of the chapters in here, I think a lot of them are about like how things could get done, right? But like none of them are about like, oh, like this is just the way that things are. And so we just have to work through them in the way that they are, right? All of them are like way more ambiguous than that, including like what is the role of like politics in relation to science? Or what is that kind of like division that takes place? Or why is it that effectivity is on one side and not on the other side, right?
Right. Yeah.
But then I think, so just, I think that the, and I think that there's something that's like even more complicated about thinking about those geoengineering projects, right? I mean, the glacier one is the one that we get the most attention to throughout the novel. And it is really cool. Like, it's a really interesting and like, it's just like a very cool idea about a thing that you could do that is, seems like surprisingly, like it makes sense, you know, at least to like somebody who knows nothing like me, right? It seems like it makes sense. But it's like that idea, like if this was a whole novel in which like what we were doing was we were like, okay, you know, here's this problem of like melting, you know, the melting of the sea ice, the melting of the glaciers. Hey, here's an idea about how we can fix it. And now we're going to like hang out with a bunch of people who have an idea about how to fix it and they're going to fix it. And, you know, like, I mean, that is kind of like one way that you could like tell part of this story, but that is just like not how this novel tells the story. And I think the way in which it tells its story puts pressure on like every single moment as like none of these things like in and of themselves like give over to something like a large scale solution. So I think it's really interesting that we go from in 21, like the when Frank kills the guy, to the conversation where we hear the kind of like expanded version of this idea about drilling through the ice. In chapter 23, that chapter that you already referenced, where Frank gets a gun and thinks he's going to kill someone and then doesn't do it. And then chapter 24 is one of the more than one chapters in here about perceptual errors, which I think that we talked about last time, like ease of representation being like a big one, which obviously we talked about in, I mean, not last time, we talked about that earlier this episode, I think, all one continuous episode.
Oh, smooth, no break. Perfectly nothing, edited together. Nothing, no one has, will know the difference.
Nothing has happened. And then in chapter 25 is the kidnapping chapter. So we're really getting like, I mean, you know, there, you know, like one version of it could be like, oh, we're juxtaposing like poor crazy Frank and his like, you know, misguided ideas about what to do with the real rational progress of science, which is going to figure this out, right? But I think that that's not how the juxtapositions work. I think that they, you know, I think there's more like a kind of collage effect to them or something in which like each chapter troubles the one that comes after it. And there's a ton of ambiguity along the way, including in, to go back to the point that you're making before, like, you know, like Frank doesn't seem like he really knows what he, wants from Mary. And yet like he knows that he wants something, and he also has an account of the urgency of it. And not just the urgency of it, but like the extraordinary violence that has already been done and is already being done to the world that drives him in a way in which we haven't yet seen Mary driven, you know. Right. We see her troubled. We see that she's like having to work hard at what seems like basically a thankless task. We see that she's good at like managing a lot of different people who have a lot of different ideas about things and all have different stakes and are all sure that their one little domain of knowledge is the absolute right one.
Right. We also, what's really interesting about this chapter is that we see too the kind of another kind of thing that Mary does as a like bureaucrat, which is like, treat her staff to a fancy dinner.
Oh, yeah,
like
yeah.
Endless totally. Pictures of margaritas, like bottomless margaritas. So it's like, we could, like, from that perspective, we see Frank's perspective a little bit better. Yeah. It's like, which is really interesting because, like, there are lots of moments in Kim Stanley Robinson novels with like scientists going to restaurants, which is like, yeah, obviously cool. Like, restaurants are fun to go to. It's fun to go there with like colleagues and like get a little boozy and like trade ideas and stuff. But it also is like a scene where the urgency of the task that they're researching is like undercut by a moment of like, these people are still human and enjoy going to restaurants. Right. But it is a kind of like nice kind of like figure of the way that Frank is like, why are you wasting time having bottomless margaritas when we're going to be underwater, you know, in 10 years or whatever?
Right. And when something that to his mind, it's like, you know, I mean, I think for the reader as well, like, so if starting off with the chapter that gives us like vividly and terrifyingly, like this scene of, mass death, right? And that really brings it home without also like personalizing it, making it the story of an individual, any of those kinds of things. Like, you know, having begun that way, like we too have in our heads, like this scene that is, should not be able to be, I mean, we shouldn't be able to go on with daily life after that, right? And yet at the same time, of course, like, you know, that's like exactly what human beings like are good at doing probably in our best ways, Yeah. Right. And also like in our worst ways too. Right. And Frank can no longer go on in that way. Right. Right. That's what he's carrying around with him. Like that's what his survival has meant. But in some ways also, it seems like he's not wrong to not want to like, not want to let the like, irreducibility of that moment slip away. Right. And I think that the,
yeah, stay with the trouble, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, and of course he's doing it in a way that is like clearly destroying him, you know?
I mean, well, the trouble is staying with him. He's not staying with the trouble. That's the trouble, is that the trouble won't leave him.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, we know that he went to, and did we already talk about this? That he went to,
he like has tried a number of different things. He goes, well, not only cognitive behavioral therapy, but he like goes back to India to try to like recreate and like work through the trauma of being that humid.
Right.
And then he goes to Antarctica, and it's enough for him to just walk past a sauna for him to just have a huge freak out and like cost millions of dollars for him to like be ejected out of and banned from Antarctica for life.
And we know he went to India in the first place as part of some kind of mission, right? And we don't know what that is, right?
It's like an aid org or something like that.
I mean, that's what we assume, but I mean, it could be, I mean, for all we know, it could also be a religion. It could have been religious, right?
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, I think it's important that that's not like explained or specified to us, but that we know that he's the kind of person who prior to this would have done that. So,
he has that kind of do-gooderism, like white liberal American, like I'm going to go help people.
Right. Right. Exactly. And also like, we know that at this point, like part of what's hard for him is that he also had this experience, but he didn't really have it with the other people he was with. Right. Partly because they all died. And so he has the survivor's guilt, but also because he was, you know, in his inability to speak the local language and in his shitty Hindi.
Right.
There were ways in which he was like apart from everybody else anyway.
Well, and there's that moment too in that first chapter where there's like two other people in his group and he says, no, you go.
Yeah.
You know, go to the next town over and get help and I'll stay here. So he has that like self-sacrificial, like I'm the hero, you know, thing.
Or practical. I mean, we just like don't know. We know so little about him, you know, like I think that I read him. This is in my mind, he is like very close to being the same guy who's in Antarctica in that book, Antarctica X. But anyway, that's just cause he's like he's not totally unlike, the guy in, Red Moon too.
Oh yeah. That guy,
you know, who is spectrumy. Right. But, who is non neurotypical, but the, you know, like similarly a person who is, you know, and it like a young ish man who is like detached from the world in certain kinds of ways and also like sincere about the world in certain kinds of ways. But I mean, the other thing about Frank is also, you know, he goes back to India and he tries to meet the children of Kali and say like, I want to do what you're doing, because this is looks to him like a form of effectivity that he understands. And they say no, because like you are an American and also you're a white person and you like are part of what brought this on us. This is not your role. And you don't get to just like hang out with us in our version of the fight. You got to figure out your own version.
Yeah.
And that seems like really like that he can't, he doesn't know how to join with other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think it's important that like, he also seems to get in some ways. It's like, oh yeah, he can't go and like be speaking for India. And partly because at this point, like India is already doing like an amazing job of like speaking for itself, you know?
Which will, But that whole aspect of Frank and his encounter with them is really interesting, because it does mirror so much of kind of, yeah, like American do-gooderism in general, not only abroad, but also domestically, as like, you know, whatever, here's a image, kids from the suburbs moving to the city and then being radicalized in the city and then doing the March for Black Lives in the city. Like, maybe stay in the suburbs and figure out how you could radicalize them, or like save those poor souls from like their capitalist
your parents. They don't know they live in, you
know? what I'm saying is like, there's just this like tendency to say, oh, the problem's over there and I need to go over there to solve it.
Yeah.
And in fact, like capitalism is everywhere and it needs to be solved everywhere.
Yeah.
So figure out how you can, you know, work on yourself, not on yourself and the people that you know actually already.
Yeah. Yeah.
And organize yourselves.
I mean, yeah. And I think it's also that like, there's no, I mean, like, you know, you can't just be like, well, I'm a good person, so I'm not implicated in American empire, right?
Yeah.
Like, I
mean, there's that thing. Yeah, exactly. And there's also like, oh God, now that if Trump wins, I'm going to move to Canada. Or if Trump, like, good, great, thanks, bye.
Yeah.
Thanks for helping out. That were problem. Like, oh, I can't wait to move out of my red state into a blue state. Oh, I can't wait to, like, that's not going to help. That's like the exact problem that we have, is like too many good people live in the blue sections of the country. Not enough good people live in the red section of the country.
That's definitely what the problem is.
That's definitely what the problem is. I'm a smart, good guy. So anyway, but like one other thing, and then we should move on to something else in this section.
Oh, yeah.
In the part about Frank, the hostage situation, one thing that Frank does do is motivate Mary to say, like, he says, like, you need to do targeted assassinations. She's like, I think we're probably not going to do that. But then that gets her thinking, and she goes to Vadim and says, maybe we should do some like targeted assassinations or something.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that like, so on 97, that exchange that they have, I think is really,
yeah,
interesting. And it is a place where we see that, like, however fucked up things are for Frank, he is actually doing a thing that, like, we have like heard about earlier in the novel, the sort of injunction to, I think it's at the end of that chapter that's about like global happiness indexes. And I think the very end of the chapter is like, yes, but at some point you have to like step outside of like the desire to quantify. And stepping outside that might look like going and seeing other people and actually encountering people. And there is something in this book that I think there's something I think throughout the novel really about encounter and about the face-to-face, you know, it just like in this very serious way about like that being with other people, is transformative, right? That changes things, right?
Yeah, and that's interesting, the way, like, going back to the way that you said the chapters don't just, they're not just like abutting each other, but they actually kind of interweave in interesting ways, because the very end of the chapter on Gini coefficients and like other happiness indexes, that paragraph is, it's important also to take this whole question back out of the realm of quantification sometimes, to the realm of the human and the social, to ask what it all means, what it's all for, to consider the axioms we are agreeing to live by, to acknowledge the reality of other people and of the planet itself, to see other people's faces, to walk outdoors and look around.
Yeah.
And then the next chapter is where he kills the guy at the douchebag party.
Seeing other people's faces, right, right. It becomes exactly. There. Right, right. Yeah. I mean, and that's also about like, that's also just to like go back to the conversation about like, you know, dividing up by like profession or discipline or, you know, area of knowledge or whatever. Like that just made me think about how, there's like a place in Black Skin, White Masks where Fanon says he's talking about, somebody else's like theory about like colonial, the colonial psyche or something. And Fanon is like, well, I mean, you know, Fanon, the psychiatrist, says, but when I step outside my psychiatrist's office, basically I see that these things are produced, you know, not by these, not by like whatever timeless structures of the unconscious, but by the actual exigencies of history that are making people suffer. I mean, that's right. A paraphrase. But the when I step outside my psychiatrist's office, I think about that a lot because it's such a like, you know, he's not saying I lay that role aside, but he's saying like sometimes you have to get out and you have to be out in the street and you have to be with other people, not in that role of the one who knows, but in a different kind of role in order to understand something. So, which I think kind of happens to Mary, you know, she's such a funny character because like she is a bureaucrat. And in that way, there is something about her that is like, you know, she's there to like make things work. Which oddly, like Frank, a person who can't hold on to personality because he has like been depersonalized by his trauma. Like there's something about her that at least in the way that we experience her initially, that is similarly like impersonal, but on 97, they have this great exchange that I feel like it's worth reading. She looks at him and she, there she saw something, a real person, a very troubled real person, a young man, sick and scared, which is certainly obviously partly the way that she's dealing with the situation is saying, yes, this is just a person. He's scared. He says, I went back to India. I tried to join a group of people. I'd heard about Children of Kali. You've heard of them? Yes, but they're a terrorist group. He shook his head, staring at her all the while. No, you have to stop thinking with your old bourgeois values. That time has passed. The stakes are too high for you to hide behind them anymore. They're killing the world, people, animals, everything. We're in a mass extinction event, and there are people trying to do something about it. You call them terrorists, but it's the people you work for who are the terrorists. And they're presumably, he's thinking about like governments, states, central banks, the people who she does work for, right? How can you not see that? I'm trying to avoid violence, Mary said. That's my job. I thought you said your job was to avoid a mass extinction event, he responds. And so, you know, she has not actually, I think, said my job is to avoid a mass extinction event, partly because she knows that we're already in one, right?
Right.
But when she says my job is to avoid violence, that is definitely not her job. Also, and part of what Frank just like brings home in that moment is like the mass extinction event is violence. We are living in violence, and just as you said, like this is a moment that gets her to start talking to Badim, and where she learns something that I guess she did not know, which is that there are extrajudicial activities going on at the Ministry for the Future. Although we really learn very little about them. And not till late in the book do we learn enough about Badim to have a somewhat better sense of what's going on. But right. This is a moment. So like for all that Frank seems to be somebody who can't make things happen, this does seem like this is a transformative scene for both of them. They're both changed by this. And she is changed in ways that make her do her work differently, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And also it's interesting too, because later in this kind of chunk that we're trying to get through today, there's the idea of the discount rate for the future, for like future people.
Yeah.
And here, Frank brings up the idea of the fact of like, you're supposed to be like working in defense of future people. So people kill in self-defense all the time. He says on 101, not to do that would be a kind of suicide. So people do it. And now your people are under assault, these supposed future people. So in that way, he's saying like, look, if you're really advocating for future people, then you need to be thinking about the fact that they are going to be killed or not even exist or whatever, based on the actions that are happening today. And then later, when we have the economics chapter, it's like, how much do we value the people? And that can be an arbitrary, we can just decide, we can like assign them a value. Like right now we hardly value them at all. If we like valued them the same way we value ourselves, or even like, even a little bit less than we value ourselves, but not like the fact that we value them zero right now, we would completely alter the entire economic system of the world, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and just imagine that if we didn't value them numerically or quantitatively at all.
Well, yeah. I mean, I mean, we could imagine that, but the novel has a problem imagining that because like even in the Gini coefficient chapter there, he's like, everything has to be, because we live in like the economic system we live in, everything gets a number. And that's kind of what we're like kind of stuck with.
Right. Although there
at least for like a huge, at least for like the decision makers, right?
Right. I mean, although at the same time, I think that there are a lot of places in here where we get, you know, we see that like, in fact, the horizon is not so locked down as all that. I mean, I think that we see that in the sort of, in the stories of encounter between people, encounters between people. I think we see that in the theme that weaves around and we'll probably end up talking about in like a later episode of the emergence of like some kind of shared spirituality, right? Which we've already, I mean, you know, we've already had like, what's her name? Tatiana and, mm-hmm. and Mary have the conversation about the possibility of needing a mother goddess religion, an earth goddess religion. And that's another place where like, you know, it's clear that like, it's not just that like you can do a better calculus, but that at some point, like, calculus, at some point calculus just like can't do certain kinds of things right at all. Like,
I was going to say that like the way, you know, the fact that like people get assigned value, like numerical values, and that the way they get assigned them is arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. I mean, it is arbitrary, but it's arbitrary mm-hmm. in the sense that like who has the power gets to make those assignments. And so that there is like a feedback loop there, like the, the ideology itself or like cognitive errors, right? So if you start to value the future more, then the future will have more power to value itself more. And if you can like just see the world in a different way, you can start like manipulating it in these ways to like tip the balance of power that away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, although then there is a kind of question, I think, in that, like, to me anyway, in that chapter about like, you can make a better calculus of the future, you know, but has that actually like taken the future back from that form of rationality? No, it hasn't.
Right.
You know, it's about, it's stretching it out, right? It's making it something that you can like work in. But surely that's not like the end goal of what our relationship to futurity might be, right? You know, like that can't, you know, because it still sort of like seeds it to the idea that like, well, there will always be banks, right?
Yeah, right.
Which, you know, I think it's worth thinking that that might not just be a true statement. But I did want to say, I mean, speaking actually of these things, I love the chapter 34, when Badim and Mary go to India, mm-hmm. Partly because they go like, so on page one, like 140 to 141, they're in
Karnataka.
And they're looking at these like you know, transformed agricultural practices under you know, like in a state that is a communist state. And we see the terraces on the slopes, green of several shades, rectangles of yellow, orange, red, purple, dark brown, pale blue, flowers of spice crops, apparently. Everything grows here, new local host says, name Indrapramit. Best soil and climate on earth, now banking 7 parts per thousand of carbon per year, immense drawdown, also food for millions. Local tenure rights for local farmers, no absent landlords anywhere except for India herself, the Indian people. as represented by Karnataka State, also the district and village, stewards of land, keep room for wild animals in the hedgerows and habitat corridors, tigers back, dangerous but beautiful, gods among us, and all organic, no pesticides at all. Sikkim model now applied to ag all over India, Kerala model for governance the same. We're back in Years of Rice and Salt, right? And the that amazing vision of like the end to hierarchy, the end to rule, the world a garden. And here it is, right? You know, right. Like here it is, and it's real, and we don't get to spend time there. And also, like Aaron and Badim are both like, oh God, I don't want to hear about agriculture. And their hosts like don't get along super well in this situation. But just, you know, it's just like here in the middle of the book, and this is incredibly beautiful, right? I mean, this is like a beautiful vision of utter transformation, right? Food for millions. It's abundance right here in the middle of this novel about like the disaster that we're living in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge kind of like leap. I think we're probably in the 2030s, maybe almost 2040 now or something like that. So like maybe 20, I'm not sure when we are. He's cagey about the years and stuff, but it still is like this amazing leap from where.
I think we're just in the 2030s because chapter 36 gives us a date of 2032 at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not sure, because I agree with you, the chronology, I feel like we don't totally know if we're jumping around a little in chronology either.
That's true. Right? Well, another cool thing about the vision for India that's there is that another thing that like Stan kind of pushes back against about like automation, like there's plenty of work to be done, and that because they're eliminating like the like factory floor model of agriculture, there's like a tremendous amount of work that really only humans can do.
Yeah.
And that's like super important, because that was something else that we saw also in the Years of Rice and Salt, when like they get off the boat in China and there's just like, there's no pack animals. It's all humans doing all the lifting. And that's just like super important, because, you know, I've become very like disenchanted with the idea of like the full luxury automatic communism thing, because people need work to do, and they need that work to be meaningful. Like I like to say, people don't want a job. They want like meaningful work, basically. They want like meaning in their lives, and jobs are not that. Like a job is something you do to survive that you have to take because you need to like feed yourself and put a roof over your head. But like the problem with work today is that there's just too much meaningless, like the bullshit jobs thing that David Graeber talks about, or that like, you feel alienated obviously from the things that you sell or make, mostly the things that you sell in America. And like, you know, with like an enormous amount of people doing like the handwork of, you know, raising crops and, you know, fighting off insect infestations or whatever, that's like immediately meaningful work. I mean, it might be drudgery, but as long as you could keep it to a few hours a day and not like break your body doing it. And of course, because India has like a billion people, like more than enough, especially once the Dalits, it makes it a point. Once the Dalits and like the women are involved in the economy, there's like more than enough work to go around.
Right. Have you read, just thinking about automation, there's two articles in New Left Review by Aaron Beninov. I think that's how you say his last name.
I've heard him on podcasts before. I don't know if I've read those ones.
It's a two-part. I mean, his book is coming out, I think, actually this month from Verso. And I think the argument is really interesting. And it's a, like really like it's also a critique of the kind of discourses around automation. And I think that he talks a little bit about sort of like technologized visions of the future, like fully automated luxury communism or, you know, that Four Futures book, like that kind of thing. I think it would be worth checking out. I'm recommending this book that is not yet out, but the two part sequence of the articles in New Left Review are really interesting. I found them like very helpful, like historically, and also just like thinking about what the relationship is of automation to capitalism more generally.
What was that book? like 4 years ago by two authors both of whose names I can't pronounce that's like full, you know, it might be called full automated communism, a world without work.
I was going to say Four Futures and the End of Communism.
It's not Four Futures, but it's something about a world without work.
Yeah. Which is, maybe it's the same people.
Is it Aaron Benedict?
No, it's not him. That's like not his thing. He's like critical of that stuff.
Right.
No, it's Nick Schrenich.
Yes.
And I don't remember.
Technology, automation, and how we should respond. Maybe. No, that's Daniel Susskind. Anyway, I really liked that book, but I'm now kind of like, you know, suspicious of it. Anyway.
Yeah.
This is not wisely, about that book.
Wisely. Well, I mean, there's lots of interesting stuff to think about automation. And also, you know whose like science fiction novels have pretty consistently been extremely good at being critical of dumb stories about automation is Kim Stanley Robinson.
Oh, that's
not
cool.
I would say like not somebody who has ever bought into like those stories. Which is a reason. I mean, actually, I think that's like not a I think it's kind of a good thing to think about now, because like I can imagine that like one of the things that people think about this book is that it's like not science fiction enough, you know?
Right.
Because it is so near in the future. And I mean, in this way, I feel like this was like a little bit of reaction to the Science and the Capital books too, you know, that there's like, you know, there are a lot of people who hate Aurora because they feel like it's so mean that this book doesn't let you like have a fantasy about like leaving Earth for another planet.
Yeah.
And then I think there are also people who are like, oh, but this stuff is all just like too mundane. And if we're going to read like, you know, cli-fi or whatever, like we want it to be like fucking floods and like fires and like whatever. And like the restraint of this book and both, I mean, like it is amazingly good at like, I really feel like if you read this and you're not like, holy shit, this is a disaster that we have to do everything we possibly can about, I don't know what's wrong with you. And then on the other side of it, like, I mean, and if what you want is like for it to be worse, what you want is the book to like, you know, tell you that, yeah, don't worry. Like when it actually happens, it's going to be really, really bad. Like,
yeah.
I think like, that's such a good thing about this book.
Escapism is not what you're coming to this book for. If you came for escapism, you came to the wrong place. Because that's why I love this book so much. It makes you really uncomfortable and hopeful at the same time. Like, no, there are things we can do about it. And they don't involve alien technology.
No. No. You know? They just like involve human beings.
What? Yeah. Get over your shit.
Get over your shit, man.
I just love too, the form of that this book takes, like these little chapters that present these just kind of like snapshots that could in certain ways like be whole novels themselves, you know, like, the guy on 33, the Children of Kali, assassination plot, like the Indian James Bond, like busting in.
Fucking awesome.
Dude, like what, like it made me think of James Bond so much. And like, why, obviously I know the answer to this because films are made by capitalists, but why isn't there like an environmentalist James Bond, like Children of, there could be a whole set of movies.
Yeah.
Of the Children of Kali, just like Jason Bourne style, like going in and like whacking out these like environmental criminals.
Oh, I know. But you know, you can't make a movie where a terrorist is a hero, Matt.
Well,
all terrorism is the same.
It is all the same. And it's all terrorism. It's not violent direct action. And eco-terrorism is like the number one.
It's the worst threat. Of all terrorisms.
The worst of all terrorisms is the one the FBI spends the most time.
Yep.
Thinking about.
Yep.
But yeah, so like they're using.
I mean, that chapter is awesome. And like repossessing like fucking drone technology to like, yeah that's just, I mean, that's pretty cool.
There was a, I think there's an art exhibit in France right now that uses like camera footage, like basically is turning the, you know, turns the panopticon of the state against itself. So it's just a mural of photos of cops, like taken from security cameras, which is like, that is like some fucking guerrilla art. Like, holy damn, dude.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. Yeah. I mean, the, like the drones thing is just like, so satisfying, just like,
Yeah. And it gets used a lot more in the book as it goes on too.
Yeah.
In really terrifying ways, but also really like oddly satisfying ones. But yeah, these like snippets of chapters that could all be whole like episodes or films on their own, or like the notes, just the fact that there are just notes.
Yeah.
And that, there's another thing I really like about the book that is rubbing some people the wrong way. And I think is part of the kind of like, well, he's not really doing, you know, he's not really paying that much attention to characters or whatever. Like, here's the dialogue. And it's like, well, this is not dialogue. First of all, it's notes from a meeting. Right.
Yeah.
And the whole point too of like creating characters like this is like, you know, for one thing, we don't need to know about these people, a lot of these people as characters. We get enough in Frank and Mary and Vadim and like even like the Pete guy who the glaciologist or whatever. Mm-hmm. But also I feel like it's a kind of a marker of like Kim Stanley Robinson's late style or something like that. Like, he's done it. If you want scientific characters or like scientist characters, you have like 19 other novels to choose from.
Yeah.
Like, you have the whole Mars trilogy. Like, he's figured out how to do that. And he's also like distilled that kind of essence down to like what he needs to do to like, you know, move this incredibly urgent novel forward. You know, he doesn't want to write another fucking trilogy. right.
Even if you might wish that he would.
Well, sure, of course.
But I mean, like, even in, I mean, remember in like whatever chapter it is, I think of Red Mars, where Michelle is doing the like the typology of everybody.
Grandma Squares.
With the Grandma Squares. He, you know, like that is such a funny play because, you know, despite all the time that we spent like making fun of Michelle, despite all the time we spent making fun of him, like, and despite the fact that is kind of funny and he's like not, you know, entirely accurate, it seems like, it's also true that those characters are not just doing the work of, you know, they're not like, we're not meant to be like, oh, these are just people. They're also doing all this kind of representational work, right? They are positions within a system in those novels. They instantiate for us sets of relations, kinds of relations that are possible in the world, certain kinds of conflicts or contradictions that are possible in the world, right? They are, you know, like they're part of the way in which the world, the novel is structured. And as always, just to say that, like, you know, this is not new to like this novel, like also the, what is the group, the Jati in that novel? It's 100 people. And I mean, right. I know that you and I are not like the best people for remembering the names of characters, but it was still like, you know, in the last volume, we're still like, wait, have we met that person before? Yeah.
Mary Dunkel or whatever. I don't know.
And that, but that's brilliant, right? Because it's like, you know, it's not like, you know, giving you this kind of like, I don't know, this modernist technique of having you be alienated from the character. I mean, it's not like Beckett or whatever.
Right.
Not that there's anything wrong with Beckett. But
shit on Beckett.
but it's also like, it's saying like, you know, what matters are the relations, right? And what matters are the struggles, and what matters are the ways in which History does and does not move forward. And also, like, sometimes, like, the little daily moments matter. But, like, a little daily moment isn't about, like, rich depth of character. It's about, like, you know, you and I are hanging out and we're having a beer and having, like, a random fucking conversation, you know? Like, that's right. A little daily moment. Like, anyway, so I think that this, like, I think that this is a novel that wants you to think about impersonality, and it wants you to, like, really, like, pay attention to what you are and aren't being given. I think to think that, like, this is, like, disappointingly, like, not a place where there are, like, deep characters, that just seems to me to be a real mistake and a real kind of misreading of how characters work in Robinson's books, just, like, generally, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, you know, an effective way, place where that kind of approach to character works too is in the refugee chapters that we have in this chunk, which we're going to stop at chapter 37 and pick up at 38 next time. But that there's two.
Did we not talk about this already?
I don't think we did.
Okay.
I mean, just in terms of, like, not in any kind of, like, depth, in terms of, like, there's two there's two chapters on refugees, 35 and 37, non-consecutive. And one of them depicts a riot in Switzerland from these Tunisian refugees, where it ends with, like, the guy saying, "For an hour, I was not a human being. Like, I, like, lost my mind. We started burning everything down." Maybe we did talk about this a little bit. But and then the next chapter is a person who is in that same riot, but as a child, who then becomes connected to a man that she knows as Jake, but that we know is Frank. And I only figured it out, like, after the fact, or, like, in the middle of the chapter, because I forgot that he had adopted the name Frank Salzman. But, like, or Jake Salzman. And we see him through the eyes of this child, and it's really affecting. Yeah. It's an extraordinary chapter, and it's, you know, in terms of, like, depicting the experience of a, like, Tunisian girl child, refugee, seeing, like, her mother, you know, get connected with this guy, and then having him be her father for a period of time, and then him having just disappearing, and having these like episodes, and, like, increasingly, you know, in unstable moments, is really, like, you know, deeply affecting. And also, like, tells us a lot about Frank and, like, kind of who he wants to be. And again, this kind of savior complex and this kind of, like, trying to, like, figure out, like, how he can do the most good.
I mean, I think I think they're Libyan. They come through Tunisia, but that doesn't really, I mean.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was also just ambiguous. Oh, I was born in Libya. Okay, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but I think this is the only one of the refugee chapters where you get, because most of them they feel like a specific story, but you don't get filled in on much in the way of details, which I think is, like, very deliberate, because I think that they are, perhaps I said this when we were recording before.
Maybe we already talked about it.
But I think that this one is a little bit of an exception because Frank is in this chapter. But to me, the part of what the refugee chapters do is to say, like, the question about, like, how to help refugees, or what part of, like, our, like, world they are, or what they should be given or allowed or whatever it may be. Like, that's not a question what matters is not, like, why did this person come here and did they have real reasons, right? This is a conversation that comes up later between Frank, and Mary about whether people are just economic migrants or whether they are real refugees. And here, I think we're not allowed to make those distinctions, partly because you can't fucking make those distinctions because, like, you know, the stuff that's happening that is making people like environmental refugees is also economic stuff. Like, and right. It is because we think that partly because, like, you know, under capital, like, we're told that the economy is this like remarkable, like self-correcting system that exists in isolation, in magnificent isolation from everything else. It's partly for that reason that we think that. And, or because like we, you know, like that's also like, you know, we have these laws about like what, you know, is an allowable or not allowable reason to like leave your country, right? But part of the sort of like part of the refugee stories, I think, are to like prevent us from doing that calculus, from meeting them with that kind of calculus. And here, one of the things I loved in this chapter, and I've just like thought about it multiple times since I read it, is not only that we see Frank, Jake, and we see him, and it's touching, you know, because we see that he has really made a connection and also that he can't maintain the connection. And as you said, we see him through the eyes of a child who loves him and who we're going to see again later in a, you know, painfully enough. But there's this great moment too, where she's talking about realizing that things weren't going well with her mother and Jake, and she realizes they're very different people. And she says, "My mother is a calm person. She pours herself into a chair and relaxes there like a cat. Her eyes will move, her hands will do some sewing or knitting, but her body is as still as can be. This is somewhat her nature. We're lucky to have her." And that is like the most, it is just like an extremely vivid, beautiful conjuring up of a person who you can really imagine as a person, and you can really imagine this person. It's just like this moment in which you're like, you know, this is a woman who traveled with two little children through extraordinary difficulty, who's been living in a refugee camp, who took the risk of, you know, moving in with this man who she met at the refugee camp, like, and so, and in that way, the story, like, it's not that the chapter is just about Frank. It's also that we have this very, very clear picture of her mother, who is a totally minor character. And we're going to see, I think, twice more, and that's it. And we could easily have had this whole chapter without that bringing her so vividly in front of us. And yet we get that in a way that's like, you know, I just think there's a way in which the novel is really, it's like, without doing some like cheap, like centering the stories of like the marginalized or the dispossessed. It's like actually like, you know, takes very seriously. Not only does it take seriously those stories and put them in front of our eyes, it also like refuses to give them to us as like little presents to make us feel better about our role in things.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's fucking awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way that I was thinking about it too, is that like, like along those lines where, it actually doesn't take much to just empathize with refugees. You know, it's actually pretty easy. Like you can just imagine them like doing some knitting or having kids or being human beings like
being
yourself.
People. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh, maybe we shouldn't be like keeping them in cages or like means testing whether they're allowed to come into the country or whatever. Like, is not hard. It is not difficult at all.
No.
And it doesn't take it. This is a 3-page chapter, 4-page chapter.
No. And it does not require like that they produce good anecdotes or like give you suffering that makes you feel like, you know,
she doesn't have to be good at sewing. She doesn't have to invent a new kind of knitting. Her daughter doesn't have to be a fucking musical prodigy. Like, they could just be people who are like good at some things and bad at others and like just kind of alive. And you can still be like, you know, they're okay.
And they can have needed to move for any reason.
I mean, it's so outraging, the kind of level of just lack of sympathy or like human imagination that people have about the paranoia around immigrants or whatever.
Yeah.
when it's like, do you have any fucking idea what these people went through to get here? And would you talk, like, what would you do in that situation? Just a complete lack of like being able to imagine yourself in somebody else's shoes, which is particularly weird because they spend, such people spend so much time watching TV and like being on the internet and loving Donald Trump for some reason. Like, you're able to imagine yourself in the position of this like completely odious human being who has no redeeming qualities. Like, why can't you imagine yourself in the situation of a person who's like a lot more like you than he is? It's baffling to me.
I mean, I think it's also, yeah, I mean, yes. And also I feel like, so I hope everybody can hear that Louise is purring really hard into the microphone.
Okay. I don't hear it on my end, but maybe the microphone is picking it up better than.
If there's a strange sound, like a distant motorboat running, it's Louise. But the other thing is like, it's also like, you know, it's not just from like the reactionary perspective. It's also like the sort of liberal thing of
you
like
can hear that for sure. For yeah.
her going licky, licky, licky.
Yeah. The liberal thing. Sorry.
The liberal thing. of demanding that like, you know, yeah. So why would you like, what's in it for me? Well, what has to be in it for me is that like, I have to sympathize or have empathy or whatever, you know, I mean, this is just like, you don't even need to know what somebody's, people don't have to have a fucking story in order for them to like deserve a life of dignity and having their needs fulfilled. You know, you don't, I mean, that's that like, that sort of like that idea that like, you know, we have to personalize every story, which is also like, that's also something that like TV and like novels and movies, like
the culture industry, we call it.
The culture industry, right? You know, like, oh, we have to have like the representative of this problem so that right. You can like feel really bad, you know, right. Like, and then in your bad feeling, it confirms that you're a good person. And if you're a good person, then in the end, it must be that there's not anything really big wrong, just some small thing that you could fix with a little tweak, right? Like, I don't know if you're going to like paint Black Lives Matter on a street downtown, as opposed to like, you know, defunding the cops. Right. I mean, it's just like, something about that is like, so yeah, just like, that's an extremely repugnant, like liberal habit of mind, which is not to say that I don't like, you know, watching a movie and like crying or reading a novel and crying because I identify with something, but sure. To have that, that is like to issue that demand to the world that it has to be giving you that, you know, it's gotta be a fucking beautiful polar bear with a baby floating away on a fucking ice floe. Well, the sky is really blue and so is the sea or something, you know, and it can't just be like all of these insects that we don't know what the names of are that are already dead, you know, like are already extinct like that. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're saying.
You and Louise know what I'm saying.
Me and Louise. Well, I think we didn't cover everything. There's the great chapter about all the different fun things that we could do to fix the Arctic winter, like having little robots that create snow that are just going to be frozen there for like the next.
So awesome.
It's actually so cute. It's like Wall-E. It's like very Wall-E, but yeah. For real, you know?
Yeah. Or the great, we cannot not periodize chapter.
Yeah. Cause that has structure of feeling in it too.
Cause it has structure of feeling in it.
So, which is also important. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about structure later, yeah. Especially for if the new listeners that I bet we have never heard us talk about structure of feeling. Don't worry.
That's right.
Old
fans know that we talk about that like every third episode.
Yeah. It's kind of an important.
It's incredibly idea. Important.
But that'll do it for this week. We've gone very long and maybe we'll keep going very long.
Yes.
We would love to hear your comments about the book. If you'd like to email them to us at marooned on Mars podcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You could also follow us on Twitter at Podcast on Mars. And then you can rate and review us on your, wherever you listen to this thing.
Your favorite podcast management system.
Probably Apple Podcasts.
Probably Apple Podcasts.
The one that I check. I don't even know how the other ones work, really.
Me neither.
And that's basically it. And hopefully we'll be back soon. Like, this one's a little bit delayed, so hopefully we'll be back sooner next time. If we can get our schedules together. But again, we might not be able to get our schedules together because we have, like, this is not our job, and we have a pressing life circumstances.
Yeah.
On our
stupid on our jobs,
on our time and
the need
minds
to keep ourselves alive.
It, yeah. Well, you have a job. I just I clean the house all day, and which is exhausting.
Reproductive labor is labor, my friend.
I know. Wages for housework. I'm all for it now. Before, I thought nothing. Now.
Oh God. Yeah.
I was talking with our friend, Dustin, a few weeks ago, and I was saying, because he also has no job and a partner who, supports his lifestyle. And, we were saying how we really identified with housewives of the 1950s.
now. You've been taking those pills to get through your day.
Well, yeah.
A little Valium.
How boring and isolating it is just to be home all alone all day with nothing new but cook food for a partner who's who's laboring.
Yeah. Yeah. My heart bleeds for you.
I bet it does. Oh, just because I'm not an attractive liberal subject.
Exactly.
You can sympathize with.
Could you tell that story in a more emotional way?
I'm so lonely. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for listening. We are loving talking about this book, and we will be back soon to talk more about it.
That's right. Bye.
Bye.